It all began a very long time ago, when a merchant ship was set upon by pirates of the Seng Brotherhood. A small boy watched helplessly as his father was killed by the pirate leader, the evil Cabai Seng. He jumped overboard and was washed ashore on a mysterious jungle island called Bengala. It seemed like a case of out of the frying pan and into the fire, but the Tuganda tribesmen meant the boy no harm. They scooped him up and carried him to their village. And that night, in an ancient ceremony of fire and drums, the tribal shaman presented the boy with a ring of great significance. Then and there, the boy understood that he was destined to avenge his father's death by fighting piracy, greed, and cruelty in all their forms. And when he grew to be a man, he became the Phantom.
Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 57 of Supermates Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And today we're going to cover part two of our two-part Summer Blockbusters That Weren't series. This time we're going to talk about the 1996 film adaptation of The Phantom. The Phantom debuted on February 17, 1936 in his own comic strip by writer-creator Lee Falk and original artist Ray Moore for the King Features Syndicate. The strip has run continuously since, until this very day, running over 80 years. The Phantom's comic book adventures began first with reprints of his strips, but eventually new stories were crafted. He's hopped to nearly every conceivable publisher, including Harvey, Gold Key, Charlton, where he was drawn by future Batman legends Jim Aparo and Don Newton, DC, Marvel, in the Defenders of the Earth toy cartoon tie-in, and most recently Moonstone and Dynamite Comics. Before this film that we're about to cover, he appeared on movie screens in a movie serial starring Tom Tyler, who also played Captain Marvel in the serials. There was an unaired TV pilot filmed in 1961 with Lon Chaney as the Heavy. So that's interesting. He was part of the Defenders of the Earth cartoon along with fellow King Features heroes Flash Gordon and Mandrake the Magician. He jumped into the future in the Phantom 2040 animated series in 1994, which actually predated Batman Beyond, and in a universally panned sci-fi miniseries in 2009. Despite his long run in comic strips, the character hasn't really successfully broken into the U.S. popular conscience since World War II, but he is huge in Australia, New Zealand, and other regions around the world, including Nordic countries. So he's just bigger internationally than he is here.
So like David Hasselhoff.
Yeah. Nice. The Phantom is by nearly every account the first comic book hero to wear the traditional look of tights and mask, making him a very important forerunner of every comic book superhero. He had the white eyes like Batman. There's lots of elements of the Phantom that were picked up by other superheroes. The trunks on the outside, things like that. So we'll get into the actual film that we're going to talk about. The Phantom was released June 7th, 1996, directed by Simon Winsor and written by Jeffrey Boehm. You had Billy Zane as the Phantom, a.k.a. Kit Walker, Christy Swanson as Diana Palmer, Treat Williams as Xander Drax, Catherine Zeta-Jones as Sala, James Remar as Quill, Carrie Hiroyuki Tagawa as the great Cabai Seng, Bill Smitrovich as Uncle Dave Palmer, Casey Simasco as Morgan, David Preval as Charlie's Zephro, Joseph Ragno as Ray Zephro, Samantha Eggar as Lily Palmer, John Tenney as Jimmy Wells, Patrick McGoohan as the Phantom's father, Robert Colby as Captain Philip Horton, and Al Ruscio as Police Commissioner Farley.
An unseen narrator tells of how long ago a boy survived a pirate attack on his ship by the evil Kaba Singh. He fell overboard and washed up on the mysterious island of Bengala. Taken in by the Tuganda tribe, he is presented with a skull ring of great significance. Somehow, this boy understands he must avenge his father's death and battle evil and piracy. When he grows to adulthood, he becomes the Phantom.
Cue logo. We jump forward several hundred years to 1938 in the same Bengala jungle. A shady group of treasure hunters have employed a tribal boy named Zack to lead them to their object of desire. The group's leader, Quill, makes the boy drive their truck across a rickety rope bridge suspended over a large ravine. You've seen Temple of Doom? Just like that. The boy warns the less than honorable men that this jungle is protected by the ghost who walks. Quill rubs a skull-shaped scar on his face in a knowing fashion. The men head into a cave deep in the jungle, where they find ancient tribal jewelry, skeletons, and their quarry, a silver skull. Quill comments that Mr. Drax is going to be very happy. With that, Quill's flunky Styles is somehow attacked by one of the ancient skeletons, which chokes him to death. As the others loot the cave's other valuables, jungle drums begin to sound.
Hearing their call, the Phantom rises from his throne and heads out on his horse Hero with his pet wolf Devil by his side. Needless to say, Quill and his men are surprised to see a white man dressed in purple tights and domino mask astride a white steed with a racing wolf by his side. They fire on him, but the Phantom's blazing 45s disarm their Tommy gun. Quill and his remaining toady jump in their truck to attempt to flee. Quill explains the Phantom may indeed be a ghost, because he already killed him. This ghost doesn't just walk, he also leaps on trucks, and soon it's just the Phantom and Quill battling bare-knuckled in the cab. Phantom recognizes Quill's tattoo as the symbol of the Singh Brotherhood, sworn enemies of the Phantom for obvious reasons to anyone who watched the prologue. He also sees the silver skull before Quill stabs him in the side of his torso. Quill leaps from the truck with the skull and leaves the Phantom to the vehicle, now stopped on the collapsing rope bridge. Phantom finds the young guy Zack inside, and the two manage to swing away seconds before the bridge and truck make impact in the river far below.
Quill's remaining goons are taken to Jungle Patrol headquarters, where Captain Horton treats the Phantom's existence as tribal myth.
You know what he's talking about, Captain? They both do.
Oh, not now, Weeks. I'm not in the mood.
The ghost who walks. The Phantom.
It's nonsense. According to legend, he's immortal. Been around for 4 centuries. Poof. Imagine it, Weeks. 400 years. Just isn't possible.
Back in his cavern home, the Phantom's wounds are treated by his servant, Gurren, while the ghost who bleeds looks through an ancient chronicle for info on the silver skull. He finds it in an entry on the skulls of Tuganda.
This is it. This is what I'm looking for. The skulls of Tuganda. One made of gold, one made of silver, one made of jade.
Are they valuable?
One in that Gurren, they're dangerous. Listen to this. When placed together, the three skulls harness an energy 1,000 times greater than any force or high explosive known to man. It's all right here in the Chronicles. A long time ago, the Tuganda tribe possessed the skulls and knew the secret of keeping their force contained. Their village was attacked by the pirates of the Sang Brotherhood. The tribe was destroyed and the skulls were separated and lost. For 4 centuries, there's been no trace of them. Until today.
Then he talks with the spirit of his dead father, who is also our origin recap narrator, who chastises him for losing the silver skull, proving parents can continue to bust your balls even beyond the grave. Phantom Sr. warns his son of the world-threatening danger of the Singh Brotherhood possessing the skulls and disappears.
Meanwhile, in Long Island, New York, we meet globetrotting Diana Palmer, recently returned from an expedition to the Yukon. Diana visits her uncle Dave Palmer, crusading newspaper publisher of the World Tribune, who is throwing his annual charity dinner. Diana draws the attention of old acquaintance and idle rich fop Jimmy Wells, who half-heartedly attempts to woo her, are laughable at best. Uncle Dave has a tense conversation with the uninvited business tycoon Xander Drax. Dave's paper has been preparing articles on Drax in an attempt to expose his illegal business practices and connections to the mob. Drax feigns innocence and mentions acquiring the entire newspaper operation for himself, warning Dave that he usually gets what he wants.
Later in his study, Uncle Dave tells Diana, the mayor, and Police Commissioner Farley what he knows of Drax's plans. how he has been researching esoteric volumes at the city library, how it ties into the spiderweb symbol we know as the mark of the Sing Brotherhood, and how the origins of the mysterious power source he seeks lie in the Mingala jungle. Dave had planned a trip there to confer with Captain Horton, but is now afraid to leave with Drax targeting his paper. Diana agrees, but she suggests she goes instead. Of course, at least one of these stuffy shirt types is in the pocket of Xander Drax, and sure enough, Commissioner Farley meets with Drax and tells him that Dave is onto his scheme.
Next morning, Diana boards a seaplane straight out of Raiders, while Drax's goons watch her and report in. Drax himself takes care of the librarian who spilled the beans to Dave's newspaper by gouging his eyes out with a trick microscope. Oh my. He's creative, we'll give him that. Diana's clipper is forced down over the ocean by a set of red biplanes. Guron monitors the distress signal in the Phantom's HQ and warns his master. A group of machine gun armed females board the plane, led by Sala. No, not John Ray's Davies. Looking for Diana Palmer. Diana agrees to go with them, so no one else is hurt, and pulls Sala's aviator cap and goggles off, just so we can get a dramatic reveal of Catherine Zeta-Jones. I mean, they were obviously all females. You can't disguise the fact that Catherine Zeta-Jones is a woman. Sala slaps Diana unconscious, and they abscond with her.
At Jungle Patrol HQ, Phantom pays a visit to Captain Horton, who of course does know that the Ghost Who Walks really exists, and is in fact friends and confidants with him. Horton fills the Phantom in on the kidnapping and Diana's planned visit to meet him. The Phantom perks up when he hears Diana's name, obviously knowing her from a previous encounter. Thankfully, Zack has now remembered that Quill and his men had seaplanes, and the Phantom heads to the docks.
Aboard a ship anchored at said docks, Sala delivers Diana to Quill. The three exchange the standard movie dialogue between kidnappers and kidnappees. As the Phantom and Devil move in on the ship, Sala admires Diana's boots and takes one off of her for a closer inspection. She notices the paper Diana had previously shoved in that boot, the one with the Sing symbol, and begins to open it. The Phantom drops in with guns in hand, but finds himself in the shower room of Sala's female band of air pirates. When they fire on him, he leaps into the laundry chute, which happens to come out in the room where Diana is being held.
What is this, a ship full of women?
All my pilots are women.
Interesting. Excuse me.
Who are you?
Good Samaritan.
I bet you're better than good. You're certainly going to get the chance to find out.
There's an old jungle saying, never point a gun at someone because it just might go off.
Ooh. Vast hands. I like that in a man.
Tie her up. Or don't.
It's personal.
Let's go.
Not so fast. Why should I go with you?
Trust me, Diana.
You know my name?
Sure. Yeah, you're Diana Palmer. Your kidnapping's been reported to the authorities. This is a rescue.
Thanks. You've done a good job. I can take it from here.
She's not changed a bit.
Phantom disarms Sala, who is intrigued by the muscly purple man, and lays a wet one on him. Diana belts her, and the headstrong Diana takes off with the Phantom following behind.
Quill and his men grab the heroic duo, but Devil arrives and attacks Quill, providing the distraction his master and Diana need. Our heroes board one of the biplanes while Quill and his goons fire on them. They make their escape by air with Quill's men in pursuit on the ground by both truck and horse. Devil plays Lassie. What's that, boy? Phantom fell down in a well? And gets Hero to follow him after everyone. The Phantom and Diana's plane is losing fuel due to the damage of Quill's gunfire, and the man who cannot die orders Diana onto the pontoon, perhaps not realizing that she can die, in a really well-done stunt sequence you just don't get in movies nowadays thanks to CGI. The Phantom and Diana leap to the saddle of the waiting Hero racing below while the seaplane hits the mountainside and explodes.
But Quill's men are still after them, and soon a race through the jungle begins. Thankfully, the Phantom's friends among the trees, the Root People, stop their pursuit, and the Phantom is able to head Hero to his Skull Cave headquarters. Phantom gives Diana a black pearl necklace from his treasure trove, but any romantic moment is interrupted by the arrival of Goron and Captain Horton. Diana shows Horton the paper in her boot, which of course the Phantom recognizes as the symbol of the Singh Brotherhood.
Well, somebody say something.
You're mixed up with the Singh Brotherhood, Diana.
The what?
Singh Brotherhood. An ancient order of evil. They started out as pirates. Nowadays, there's no telling what they've become.
Where did you get this?
New York. My uncle's newspaper is investigating a man named Xander Drax. He's crazy. He's power mad.
Captain, I want you to take her back. Use every man at your disposal. Give her all the protection she needs.
Wait a minute. That's it? You're just going to send me away?
I'm afraid so.
I came here to do a job, and that's what I'm going to do. There's a lot more I need to know.
Goodbye.
Wait a second.
Diana. Nobody argues with the Phantom and wins.
Old Jungle Saying.
In New York City, Quill and Sala deliver the Silver Skull to Drax. While Sala shares her secret cleaning techniques for fine silver, Quill explains what he knows about the Phantom.
Oh, baby. Oh, it is beautiful.
I used a little toothpaste on it. It polished up so good.
Toothpaste? Really? That's nice. You know, I am in such a good mood right now. I almost hate to mention this. Ah, the happy homecoming. Kind of brings a tear to the eye, doesn't it? What went wrong?
Something you didn't count on.
Oh? Really? And what was that?
The Phantom.
I thought that was just a superstition.
Oh, no. He's real. And he won't die. I know, I killed him once. And he isn't dead.
That doesn't make sense.
Look, I brought this to prove it. See this hole? That's where I stuck him with a 12-inch blade.
You stabbed him in the back. I've underestimated you, Quill.
Right up to the hilt.
Well, that should have done the trick, all right.
The Phantom helped Diana to escape. I think he's in love with her.
Oh, really? This is getting more interesting by the minute. Why do you say that?
Because he could have had me. But he picked her. That can only be love.
Or simply bad judgment.
So what should we do about him?
Do? Nothing. This is New York City. I'm not concerned with some jungle folk hero half a world away.
Quill shows Drax the gun belt he took off the Phantom after stabbing him through it. Drax isn't concerned about a jungle hero in New York, but we shift to the streets below, and guess who just happens to step out of a cab? You got it! The disguised ghost who walks, strapped for U.S. currency, pays his cabbie Al in precious stones and asks him to wait for him. A few blocks away, Drax gives his old-school PowerPoint presentation on the skulls of Tuganda to his criminal board of directors. Drax explains he knows the location of the second skull, and if he has two, they will point to the third. Gangster Ray Zephro isn't impressed and intends to walk out, taking his criminal empire with him. Drax, being the master of subtlety, throws a spear at him and murders him in the boardroom. He appoints Ray's brother Charlie, now in charge of the Zephro mob, and rushes plans to get the second skull, much to the consternation of Commissioner Farley.
Back at the Tribune, Diana once again contends with potential beau Jimmy Wells, who follows Diana into Uncle Day's office, only to reunite with Kit Walker, who, unknown to her but known to us, is also our hero, the Phantom.
Kit.
Hello, Diana. It's been a while, hasn't it?
A few years at least.
Well, 6, to be exact. Now, I read about what happened. Are you all right?
Oh, I'm fine. It started out bad, but it all turned out okay.
By the by, Jimmy Wells.
Hiya, Kit Walker.
So, tell me, Kit, where do you know our Diana from?
Well, we were friends at college.
I see.
So are you living here in New York?
No, I'm just passing through. Catching up on old times with Uncle Dave here.
Yes. Trading information about Xander Drax.
What do you know about Drax?
Drax has come into possession of a rare artifact connected to the Singh Brotherhood. Tell her.
It's an ancient silver skull with precious stones where the eyes should be.
Oh, yeah, I've seen something like that before.
You have?
Yes, but I don't think it was silver. I think it was green.
Green? jade, perhaps. Where did you see it?
Let me see. It was my 12th birthday party. Mom and Dad had rented a big room. Now I remember. The Museum of World History.
As Kit and Diana head to the museum in Al's cab, the two discuss how Kit left so suddenly 6 years ago. He tells her he had to take over the family business when his father died. Hey, he's not lying. Inside the museum, Kit finds the jade skull and takes a direct approach by smashing the glass case and grabbing it. Of course, Drax and his entourage show up and take the skulls by gunpoint. When the two skulls are placed in the same bag, they begin to smoke. Drax picks up the skulls and something incredible begins to happen. Treat Williams totally chews up the entire museum set. Oh, and the skulls start causing all sorts of weird crap to happen.
Something's happening. This is it. It's happening right here and now. Unbelievable. It's beautiful. It's magnificent. Show me the power. Show me the power. Yes. Amazing. Amazing.
After turning into a TV evangelist, Drax watches the skulls shatter all the nearby windows and eventually fire lasers from their eyes, pinpointing a location on a conveniently placed map.
Drax and his men drive off with Kit and Diana, but thankfully Al follows them. Back at his skyscraper, Drax grills the mysterious Mr. Walker, and Kit sees the phantom belt Quill is wearing. While Drax checks the coordinates of the area the skulls pointed to, Kit escapes from Quill and his men and changes into the phantom. Drax finds that the skulls pointed to the Devil's Vortex, where ships and planes are constantly disappearing.
Why couldn't they use the word Bermuda Triangle? You know that's what they're talking about.
I know, but I don't know why they... Well, I don't even know why they changed that in movies. Drax theorizes there must be a hidden island there. While Drax begins to head out with Diana as insurance, the Phantom does a cool trick where he slides down an elevator cable using his guns to slow his fall. Following Drax's car, the hero leaps across cars and cabs and steals a policeman's horse. And then, of course, the NYPD is after him on motorcycles. A chase through the city leads to the Central Park Zoo, where the Ghost Who Walks uses his jungle skills to calm a tiger and hide in his cage. Thankfully, Al comes by and picks up our hero. In Drax's car on the way to the docks, Diana and Sala have a conversation that somehow begins to make Sala reconsider her evil ways. Why? Because the plot said so.
Forget him. He's not coming.
He's probably dead by now.
What is wrong with you? Why are you so mean? Don't you care about anything?
Like what?
You figure it out.
All right. Everybody just shut up. Step on it, Quill.
While in Al's cab, the Phantom has another discussion with his father's ghost, who confirms that Quill was the man who murdered him. His dad is happy to know that this case involves a potential romantic interest for his son. Family lineage and all that. The Phantom dives into the harbor and rides the pontoon of Drax's plane all the way to the Devil's Vortex. There they find that uncharted island Drax was going on about. Drax, Quill, Sala, and Charlie row into the cave on the island with Diana prisoner. They find an underground city complete with lit torches. Obviously, somebody's home. The homeowners are pirates, though, who take them by surprise while the Phantom watches from a safe distance. One of the pirates takes a liking to Diana and tries to manhandle her, but Sala comes to her rescue and knees him in the cojones. Quill calms things down a bit by showing his Sing Brotherhood tattoo. Oh, and Sala thinks her and Diana should stick together, because they're both girls. Yeah, that's why. Okay.
Drax and company are introduced to Kaibai Sing, direct descendant of the original, who has the golden skull in his possession. Drax shows him that he has the other two and offers a partnership. Sing ain't having it and tells Drax he doesn't have the heretofore unheard-of fourth skull.
These brought me here. The skulls of Tuganda.
And what do you know of such matters?
Oh, I know all about these skulls.
and the power they contain. Once all three are united, the two I hold and the one you have there. Look, oh great one, you know, I really wasn't in the market for a partner, but it seems to me that we have a mutually beneficial situation here. Think of it this way. You represent the old guard of grizzled scallywags and peg-leg Petes, while I stand for the new order of things, modern and up-to-date, just the man to carry our cause into the 20th century.
Silence! You have no bargaining power with me, Mr. New York City. I could kill you and feed your pretty pink ass to the sharks.
Besides,
you don't have a fourth skull.
Fourth skull? What fourth skull? What are you talking about? There is no fourth skull.
The fourth skull controls the power of the other three. And without it, you've wasted your time. And your meaningless New York lives.
Wait a minute! Wait just a minute! If anything happens to us, others will come looking. They know where we are.
Charlie decides to cut ranks and betray Drax and threaten Sing, but Sing just shoots him with a cannon. Quill then tries to bargain with Sing by showing him that he killed the Phantom. Sing ain't impressed. Many of the Brotherhood have killed him over the years, and he just keeps coming back. Drax, never missing an opportunity when it arises, tells Sing that Diana is the Phantom's girlfriend, which does pique his interest. With this, the Phantom literally swings into action aboard the resting pirate ship, and he, Diana, and Sala begin battling Sing and his pirates. Drax and Quill run for it, while Sing makes it a personal fight with the Phantom, even killing his own men who get in the way. Sing figures out that the Phantom isn't immortal, but he doesn't get to share his secret, as he falls in his own shark-infested waters.
Ew.
Yeah. Sala and Diana take care of the rest of the pirates, and the Phantom, who now has the Golden Skull, places them in the Sing's submarine launch to get them to safety. While he prepares their launch, Quill attacks from behind, making the Phantom drop the Gold Skull. Drax then has all three skulls, but the Phantom is too busy battling his father's killer. The skulls float in the air and combine, and more weird mumbo-jumbo stuff starts to happen. Phantom has Quill down for the count and takes his father's belt, while Drax takes a hold of the skulls, which emit a laser beam that turns Quill into dust. Then we learn about the fourth skull.
These skulls are more powerful than I ever imagined. I've harnessed the energy of the sun. Who needs a fourth skull?
I do. And I know where it is. I've worn it all my life. For protection. I never really understood what that meant until right now.
Ha! What a cheap jungle trick!
Drax fires another beam from the three skulls, but the Phantom's ring fires a purple ray back. Of course it's purple. Stopping the beam. The two struggle against one another until the Phantom's beam overpowers Drax's, and Xander goes up in a burst of flames. The entire island then smells like ham.
The Phantom leaps to the launching submarine and manages to escape as the volcanic island goes active with all the energies exploding inside. The sub surfaces a safe distance away as Diana, Sala, and the Phantom watch it blow.
Back in the Skull Cave, the Phantom fills Diana in on how he is the 21st Phantom, the latest in a long line of heroes dating all the way back to when that boy washed up on Bengala's beaches. Garan interrupts their talk with news of Diana's plane being ready. As he walks away, Phantom's father gives his seal of approval on Diana. The couple ride to the beach where Sala is waiting in her plane. Diana reveals she knows the Phantom and Kit are one and the same before leaving Bengala for now.
Before I go, take off your mask. Let me see your face. Kit.
You know, I'm not really permitted to reveal all of my secrets, Diana.
You're not?
Well, actually, I am. That's only to one person.
Who's that?
The woman I intend to marry.
What if she refuses you?
No one refuses the Phantom.
goodbye.
Leave it to my son to let the perfect woman slip right through his fingers. Fortunately, Diana knew her own mind and vowed to herself that she would soon return to the Bengala jungle. Maybe then I can get some rest.
Unfortunately, we never got to see Diana return. The Phantom had an estimated budget of $45 million and only brought in about $17 million U.S.
Ooh.
Yeah. By comparison, and we failed to mention this last time, but The Shadow, which we talked about in the previous episode, reportedly cost $25 million and made $32. Now, with all that promotion, etc., it probably still didn't break even, but it didn't tank as bad as this did.
Right.
Yeah. And I personally think the ad campaign for this hurt it. Rather than sell this as Indiana Jones meets superheroes, the folks at Paramount came up with this ridiculous Slam Evil slogan and plastered it everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it was everywhere. It's even on the DVD case now.
I think it's a subtitle.
Yeah, I know. It's like the name of the movie looks like it's The Phantom : Slam Evil, you know. It's like, you know, people talk about John Carter being horribly marketed. Well, The Phantom was too.
Yeah.
It wasn't until working on this episode that I realized that the director, Simon Winsor, was the man who directed one of my all-time favorite westerns and my favorite TV miniseries, Lonesome Dove. He also directed Quickly Down Under, Free Willy, and many episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which no doubt served him well here because there's a lot of the same flavor
right in
this movie, the time period and all the locales and everything. This helps account for that epic and lush look of the film, and the cinematography is just gorgeous in this movie. And as we pointed out, nearly every stunt sequence is in camera, so no computer or optical effects in sight for much of this movie, other, you know, like the laser beams and
right,
things.
Right.
But I mean, just about every Phantom sequence, it's either Zane or one of the stuntmen doing it, you know, so it just has that real feel to it. But despite all that, for me, there's just something off about it. It just doesn't have that certain spark. And it's not Billy Zane, because he's great in it.
Yeah,
you know,
he really is.
You get a smiling hero who's happy and proud to do his job. I mean, that's, especially nowadays, very refreshing to see. You know, he looks great in the role, and despite the lack of the striped shorts, which Phantom has in the comic strips, and the addition of some subtle skull motifs on the costume, he's pretty much a dead ringer for his comic counterpart. Mm-hmm. I mean, they whole cloth, pretty much. I had really, even though Billy Zane's in Back to the Future is one of Biff's goons,
yeah,
I first really noticed him in Tombstone,
mm-hmm.
which he was also in with John Tenney, who plays Jimmy Wells in this. He was Sheriff Behan.
Right.
And in both movies, Tenney's characters are both actually kind of similar. They're the metropolitan fop trying to make time with the woman who ultimately ends up with the hero. You know?
Well, and then later on, he's in Charmed, the series.
Yeah, and he was Hal Jordan's dad in the Green Lantern movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he was also the bad guy on old Lois and Clark.
He was married to Terry Hatcher, real life.
At the time, yeah. But he was the bad guy in that.
Yeah, yeah. And Billy Zane in Tombstone was the actor that was with
Dana Delaney,
who was also Lois Lane.
Oh!
And we got some more animated connections we'll get to at the end. There's a lot.
But, oh!
Oh, yeah. weird. I'll be honest, and especially notice at this time, I think part of the problem that the movie doesn't click despite all these great ingredients is Christy Swanson.
Yeah, I can see that.
She's just fairly lifeless. As Diana.
I mean, she's just, okay, here's my lines. Okay, I'm done for the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I like that Diana's a self-sufficient woman, you know, and especially ahead of her time. You know, she helps save the Phantom as much as he saves her. She's in on that fight at the end. She's fighting pirates. She swings on the rope. And she's obviously a globe-trotting adventurer before this movie even starts. But she just, Swanson just seems like you said, she's just delivering lines. It's like I never get
there's a big difference when, I mean, and this is just because this is the movie that I'm familiar with, but like when she did Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. the movie version,
yeah,
she was into it, you know.
Yeah.
It's almost like she was talking to a green screen and wasn't comfortable with it.
But they didn't do green screen.
I know, but that's my point. I mean, that's just, you know.
It's almost like Phantom Menace syndrome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a shame because Billy Zane really just relished his role, you can tell. And I've read things, you know, he still has fun things to say about it.
Yeah.
So, there's just like very little chemistry between those two, and what little is there is because it's generating out of him, I mm-hmm. think. You know, I was just thinking, you know, I wonder how this would have gone if they'd given that role to Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Or if they just switched them, if they'd done a Star Trek.
Yeah.
Where, you know, Deanna Troi and Denise Crosby's roles, you know, they remember they switched them at the last minute.
Right.
I wonder if they should have done that with this.
Oh, okay. Marina Sirtis and Denise Crosby. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, originally
Yar and Troi.
Yeah. They were supposed to be switched. I wonder if you can imagine Christy Swanson in the role of Sala.
You know, maybe it might have worked because she probably would have been a more surlier Sala.
Yeah.
But she might have been a little more believable as a bad girl.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but yeah. And, you know, Catherine Zeta-Jones played a similar character in the Zorro films mm-hmm. and pulled that off. And,
yeah.
and her and Antonio Banderas had, you know.
Steamed up the screen.
Steamed up. Oh, yeah, it was steamy. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it just. And, of course, this is the first thing that I remember ever seeing her in. This was pre-Zorro, you know, and she made quite an impression. So, but because of her character.
I wonder, was she in the Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow?
Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Yes.
No, I don't think so.
I thought she was a bad pilot in that, too. A bad
pilot
in that.
I don't think I only saw that once. I can't remember.
Okay. I might be talking out of my head.
Yeah. You know, the first time I saw her in this, I'm thinking, she'd make a great Talia because she's already in kind of the outfit. And, you know, and at that time, I assumed that we'd get to Ra's al Ghul and Talia eventually. And we did, but it was in a much different form, you know, because the Batman franchise
went a different route.
The next year tanked out with, thanks to Arnold and Joel Schumacher more than Arnold. But, you know, but the one thing that always sticks out to me about this film, the problems with it, is the over-the-top acting choices of Treat Williams.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's probably still picking splinters out of his gums from all the scenery chewed here.
Most definitely.
I mean, you know, watching it again, I can kind of see where he's going. You know, but it's still just way too broad. You know, despite Drax killing or at least maiming two people on screen, I never fear this guy. He's just too damn goofy. I mean, Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor was funny, but he was also threatening. You believed what he was going to do, you know, and he didn't care, you know, what he did to get his way. But just it doesn't work with this Xander Drax here. And Williams acting in the scenes where the skulls are powered up would make even William Shatner.
Oh my gosh, it's awful.
Even at his hammiest, William Shatner would wince in pain at this. You know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just. And I know Treat Williams is a good actor. I've seen him in other things, particularly the series Everwood, which used to run after Smallville.
Right.
Where he was the single dad. And he was very subdued in that. He was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if he just didn't look at this like Tommy Lee Jones did with Two-Face and Batman Forever and say, it's a comic book movie, so, you know.
Or either that or he was having flashbacks to when he played Hair.
Yeah, maybe.
It's the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
Maybe, yeah, could be.
Okay, and I sing better than that. I was being
That song keeps coming up in our episodes.
I don't know why.
On the opposite end of that, you know, having Patrick McGowan as Kit's father was a nice stroke because he had played, you know, the action hero characters in the 60s, Danger Man mm-hmm. and The Prisoner, and a personal favorite of mine, the Disney series, The Scarecrow, Romney Marsh, a.k.a. Dr. Sin, alias The Scarecrow, because the Scarecrow character was a like the Phantom in a way because he used, you know, fear to, you know, it was superstition to spook mm-hmm. his enemies and stuff, so.
Still looking for DVD copies of that. You know.
Yeah, Disney had it out like for 2 seconds, and they sold out, and they've never went back to print with it, to press with it, which is just ridiculous. But yeah, I missed that. I missed out on that one. You know, this movie has a solid supporting cast. You know, lots of faces and names you recognize, just like The Shadow. But mm-hmm. I'm guessing the budget difference on this one's were all the locales
they
filmed that. Yeah. This feels more... The Shadow was very set-driven.
Oriented.
Yeah, this feels more like it's in, like, real places, and nothing mm-hmm. jumps out. It's like, oh, that's a model. That's a set. You know, it just it's very visually well done, you know.
Except for, and I mean, I have to point this out. This
okay.
This is one of my nitpicks, and I'll tell you about the other one later.
Okay.
But at the beginning sequence when the Phantom is chasing them, and he goes through the jungle, and he does the flip.
Yeah.
You can see the metal bar that he flips on. Yeah. Every time I'm like, gah!
Isn't that, isn't that in a Zorro movie, too, where you can see the bar? Isn't it in The Mask of Zorro?
I don't know.
Or Legend of Zorro?
I don't care. We're talking about this movie. In this movie, it's just like so patently obvious that I'm like, gah!
They wrap some vines around it, but it's still way too straight.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, why couldn't they have put like a metal rod inside like a faux... like outer limb and have it, you know, kind of crooked to make it look, because sticks aren't ramrod straight, obviously, on a tree. Limbs, so. I noticed that too, yeah. I forgot to put that in there, but yeah.
Should I talk about my other nitpick?
Go ahead.
Okay. This is the other thing that just sticks out in my brain every time. When Kit Walker gives the guy the semi-precious stones,
yeah.
You know, the opals and rubies, blah, blah, blah. He acts like he's clueless as to how much they might be worth. I'm sorry, but it says he was educated in the United States. He would know what money is.
Well, I didn't get that. I got that he's got so much of that stuff at home, he didn't care what he paid him. He paid him, and he said, this should pay for your services for the rest of the day.
No.
And that paid for his services through the rest of the movie, actually.
Stupid.
Yeah, well, I didn't get what you're
stupid.
Getting. I can see, okay. But I can see where you're getting what you said. I can see where you're coming from, but I don't think he didn't know what they were worth. I think he just didn't care. Have you seen what was in, you know, he just went to a random treasure chest and pulled out a black pearl necklace.
Again.
Okay.
Just stupid.
But, you know, we were talking about the locales earlier, but, you know, maybe it's because of the locales and the search of the ancient, all-powerful MacGuffin, but this movie does feel a lot like Raiders of the Lost Ark or an Indiana Jones movie, but that's okay because the Phantom Strip helped pioneer those type of stories like the contemporary serials and the pulp magazines of the time, which is where you get Indiana Jones from, so.
I don't know. They could have just called Zach Short Round and got it over with. And Zach, that's a real jungle name. There you go.
Well, it's probably short for something. The rope bridge scene at the beginning is very impressive and well done. I'm not really sure how the skeleton came to life in the cave sequence before that, but hey, we got skulls with freaking laser beams at the end of the film. I got skulls with freaking laser beams, people.
Oh, and here's the other nitpick.
Okay.
In the skull scene at the end, he's got, the Phantom has the skull in his hand. He's putting the women into the submarine.
Yeah.
The whole point is to get the skulls separate from each other.
Why didn't he throw it in the submarine with them?
Yes!
Because then Drax couldn't have got a hold of it for the big battle at the end.
Yeah! That makes no sense! Logic class!
Talking about a little of the supporting cast, the actor Bill Smitrovich, who plays Uncle Dave, I always think of him as the dad on Life Goes On. That's who I always think of. I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't some subplot where Drax tried or succeeded in bumping him off. And in fact, when we first started watching this, I thought that was in the movie.
I know, me too. I kept thinking, where's the part where they kill him?
Is there another cut of this that we didn't watch?
I don't know, but I mean, I thought that
I didn't
too.
Know you. I didn't. Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah.
Weird. We saw this in the theater.
Yeah.
In The Shadow, but I wonder if there's an extended cut that we saw somewhere or something.
Because that's.
Because he never shows up again after you meet Kit Walker in his office.
No.
That's weird.
I thought.
We'll have to look into that. If anybody knows, let us know. But is it really illegal to check out occult volumes at the library? I mean, or, you know, and if they're that dangerous, why are they even kept at the library? You know, it's like, You're a librarian. Answer this question.
Well, here's the thing. There are texts that are kept in libraries, but that you have to have special access to. When I went to college, when I was helping research a book about the history of Morehead State, I had access to an air room where those texts were kept. I had to sign in and out. I had to wear gloves while I handled the text.
Mm-hmm.
No food, no drink, no nothing. I was only allowed to be in there for an hour at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those were texts, you know, they had information in them that I have signed a non-disclosure agreement that I was only allowed to tell that to Dr. Flatt for his use or non-use. And there's some things that I found out that, you know, so there's some things that are kept in libraries that necessarily wouldn't want to be kept
right
into anybody else's hands.
Okay. Well, so, I guess it makes sense. It just seems weird that if it's like,
granted, that's history, and, you know, there were some things that I found out about some things that have occurred. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, yeah.
That we can't, you know, that
the university really wouldn't want to be public knowledge.
Right.
Okay.
So.
Gotcha. Well, I guess that makes sense. It just seemed weird that they...
occult stuff, I don't know. All I'm telling you is about the history side of
right,
it.
Right, right, right. So, and then speaking of that, you know, Drax, you know, rigs a microscope to cut the librarian's eyes out.
Which I'm just like, oh my.
So what's he do with him then? Does he send him home blinded?
Yeah.
And if he does, will he just turn him in? Did he kill him afterwards? And if so, why waste time rigging the elaborate means of dismemberment up, you know? I don't get it, but, you know, I know that was the show, ooh, he's a bad guy, you know.
It's yeah.
Like, I still think, you know, it's like, okay. And it said liar when he focused in. It said, yeah. Like, you heard, which, of course, didn't, you know. It was actually really effectively done because it showed him turn the knob and the blades came up until you just knew what was going to happen when he did it, and they didn't show
Well, and
it.
They showed you before him testing it out.
Yeah, so. They showed Drax testing it out. Oh, and the seaplane, that's straight out of Raiders.
I mean, yeah.
So that's, like, that's interesting. Of course, I mean, how else are they going to get where they're going to get back then? And I pointed this out in the notes, but why was there the big reveal of Diana unmasking Sala if you can't tell Catherine Zeta-Jones is a woman, get your eyes checked?
This is true.
I mean, come on.
Catherine Zeta-Jones. Whew.
Yeah, yes. Now, I'm not too huge on Phantom's comic adventures, but I wonder if Captain Horton and the Phantom's relationship in the strips is this much like Commissioner Gordon and Batman? Because this is pretty well dead on. I mean, uh-huh. He comes in, surprises him. You know, and he even asks him to leave. He came in so people won't see
him. Yeah, how do you keep getting, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's the whole, you know, I'm surprised he didn't disappear while he was turned around, uh-huh. You know. But, but if the Phantom is borrowing that back, then that's okay. You know, because Batman borrowed plenty from him, so. I know we just watched The Shadow, but every time Christy Swanson's sluggishness kind of kills a scene, I wish Penelope Ann Miller were here. Imagine how she would have reacted to the Phantom popping in down the laundry chute.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, I think that's part of the problem is after we all gushed about her.
And it doesn't help that they're similar hair color, similar haircut.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's the same time period.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that Billy Zane was more suited for his character than Alec Baldwin was for The Shadow,
mm-hmm.
You know, at least the shadow part of it. But, you know, it's, so if you could get like Billy Zane and Penelope Ann Miller and get somebody else, to different villain, I don't know, get John Lone to play Kai Bai Singh and have him be the main villain or something,
yeah.
You know, mix and match here.
And in talking about how The Shadow compares to The Phantom, I will say this. The Phantom's sets look better than The Shadow. I mean, more...
Yeah.
I don't know, just more lush, more...
Yeah.
You know?
It looks less... It just looks more real.
Yes, less manufactured.
The world is more believable,
mm-hmm.
than The Shadow overall. It's just... And I think that's probably... That's part of that's your extra... What we say, it was 25, 45. That's your extra $20 million.
Yeah.
You know, it just looks better. Although... I will say that I was a little disappointed by the exterior of the skull cave. I was expecting, you know, like a skull hewn from rock, you know,
with the
jaws, and it just looks like there's a hole, two holes for the eyes, and then the nose, and then the mouth is kind of. It didn't. It It kind of looked, I mean,
I don't know. It looked like the Punisher had come through the jungle and tagged that side of the cave.
Yeah. Well, I didn't understand why it was kind of weird that it was so white. But
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it was just like, it looked almost like it was spray painted, but it didn't. I wanted the jaw bones to be like, out of rock and, just more 3D looking, just more three dimensional.
More Castle Grayskull.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was hoping for. Even when I watched first, I'm like, oh, because I knew the Skull Cave and it looked awesome. So I was kind of expecting more from that. I said this in the notes, but the sequence where the Phantom and Diane jump from the plane onto the horse Hero, that's spectacular. I mean, that's real old school Hollywood stunts, because it looks real, because probably 90% of it was real.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was sharp. Now, Drax's presentation to his board of directors isn't impressive by any stretch, and I doubt I would have even clapped if I'd been in there. That's like the guy, it works like everybody's like got to do presentations, and the guy's like, oh man, I forgot to do my PowerPoint presentation. Only got a half an hour, and he throws something together real quick.
Yeah.
And he's trying to pull it off in front of everybody, and like some of the people are clapping, and you're like, yeah, you put that together in a half an hour, didn't you, dumbass? But I do have to say, man, them Zephyro brothers are hardcore.
Dang, yes.
I mean, Ray gets killed right there, and Charlie is just happy he got a promotion,
I mean, this is his brother.
Yeah, no wonder Robert was scared to death of this guy on Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right.
He was Stefania's father.
Yeah. He was the real deal.
He was the real deal. Yeah. Actually, I was reading on IMDb that the character of Jimmy Wells, who's played by John Tenney, in the early Phantom comic strips, Lee Falk was kind of setting him up to be the Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
But then he changed his mind and did the whole lineage thing. He ended up being just a red herring who eventually just kind of went away.
Yeah.
But, so, it's interesting that they brought that character in, so. I think the backstory with Kit and Diane is nice. And it seems like Swanson kind of perks up in any scene she's in where he isn't in costume.
I think she was just uncomfortable with heroics. I really do, with playing.
Well, she played Buffy.
She wasn't in a costume.
Well, but
I think that was reacting to somebody in costume. Now that I think about it, maybe that's what her problem
was. I mean, what's more believable, a guy in purple tights or vampires?
Just saying.
I know, but I don't know. The scene in the museum, again, wow. I mean, Treat Williams, just that part, just when he's going, this is incredible. I'm thinking, yeah, I can't believe I'm seeing this either. God, calm down. It's just like.
You just want to hit him with a trank gun.
Yeah, it's like he'd probably still be out running around like, it's just. Ah!
He's just like a toddler that's been given a pot of coffee.
There you go. I do. There is a couple action sequences in this movie, including that one with like all the glass shattering. The editing's a little sluggish. There's like a couple of, it's not real tight, It's like, it doesn't have that punch of like, a quick edit.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things, even in the fight scenes with the Phantom, it's like there's not enough quick cuts to make it look like he's got, like his punches have a
Some
lot of
snap,
impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I noticed that in the museum scene. That's another, maybe the editing's a little off on this one too. I do like the subtle touch that when Kit's dad appears in the cab in New York, he's in a suit and a fedora.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Skull Cave, he was in the robe because he was at home. He was in his like smoking jacket.
Yeah,
type thing. So I like that touch. But speaking of which, what do we think about this? Is he really there? Is it all in Kit's mind? What do you think?
I think it's just where he's got the skull ring and every Phantom is able to talk to his ancestors.
Oh.
That's what I got out of it.
Well, that's a good.
And I mean, it is, the whole mysticism and all that stuff. I think the spirit of those who have had the mantle of the Phantom are in the ring.
Oh, that's cool. I hadn't even thought about that, because usually I think this movie puts more. I don't think the Skull Ring ever had any kind of mystical qualities in the strips. I think they give it to it in this movie because, hey, we need special effects sequences.
Right.
But since you established that, it does have that power, then, hey, why not? That's cool. Plus, it goes to the whole, spirits stick with their possession thing. And
see, that's what I got out of it.
Yeah, that's neat. I like that. Let's go with that. Okay.
It is now canon.
Yeah. So around that same time, we get the scene where Sala and Diana are in the car, and she has this, Diana has just this awful dialogue. Why are you so mean? What's wrong with you? You know, it's just like,
are you in third grade?
It's so horrible. I mean, it's just like, God, who wrote that? I mean, it's just like, and the way she does, I mean, I don't think, and we've been beating up Christy Swanson, and I don't really mean to, but I don't think anybody could deliver that line and make it work.
No.
Then Catherine Zeta-Jones turns around, and she has this kind of look like, well, why am I so mean? And then from then on, you start getting, she's like changed.
I know, because she relished before, like when she was given the skull to Drax and stuff. She's like, oh, you know, polish that.
Toothpaste. She
relishes the fact that she's a bad guy. And then all of a sudden, oh, wait, why do I like being a bad guy?
I mean, the only hint that you get that there's more dimensionality. I mean, Catherine Zeta-Jones is, of course, fun to watch. She's having fun with the character. But, and you know, she is into the whole, that's his girlfriend. He likes her, you know, all this stuff. And I did kind of like that, you know, yeah. But that still doesn't translate into that she's going to switch sides at the end of the movie. But, you know, I will say that the Phantom has some strong grip because he rides on that pontoon of that plane for thousands of miles.
I know!
I mean, wow, man. You know, again, we're back to Sala again, but I can kind of see her taking up for Diana when a man is attempting to assault her, you know,
right.
The pirate. But it still seems too convenient to her completely turn over a new leaf for no good reason. It's now what we call the Martha switch.
Martha, your mom's name Martha. Oh, you and me are bros, dude. We're bros.
You did not. I try to control him. I really do.
You're my boy, Clark. You're my boy.
He starts singing Dust.
Onward, onward.
Ben Affleck starts singing Dust in the Wind at the end of Batman v Superman.
I close my eyes.
I'm sorry.
Continue.
Sorry. So there's a fourth skull. Now, why wasn't this mentioned in the Phantom's Chronicles? It's his ring. No one else but the Phantoms and the servants are going to read these. They are locked up in the Skull Cave, which nobody ever goes to other than the Phantom, his servant, his wife, and the captain. Nobody knows it exists. It's like the Bat Cave. It's more hidden than the Bat Cave. Nobody knows it exists. Why wasn't that in the book? I don't know. By the finale, any restraint Treat Williams may have had, and he didn't have much, is out the window. Christopher Lloyd was more subdued at the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and he was a cartoon. And as you pointed out, the Phantom unmasks with Sala in their line of view. She met Kit Walker, so she's gonna know, oh, the Phantom's Kit Walker.
Yeah. And she's only been a reformed bad guy for like 2 hours.
Right.
I'm like, what the crap?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, we did say, and we get back to this, many of these actors did voiceover work on the DC Animated Universe shows, which, of course, we love, the Timverse. Treat Williams was Professor Milo on Batman the Animated Series. He was in Cat Scratch Fever and Moon of the Wolf, which mm-hmm. we covered in one of our House of Frankensteins. Billy Zane was Jason Blood and Etrigan on the new Batman Adventures episode that had Clarion, the Witch Boy, and the Demon on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was Etrigan when it came to Justice League, but he was on Batman. And James Remar, who played Quill, was Hawkman on JLU. So
there you go.
And there's probably more that you know, I don't remember, but that, yeah.
Those are the standouts.
Yeah, those are the standouts. I thought the score by David Newman was nice, but again, like The Shadow, it isn't overly memorable. It, you know, it works well for the movie. It has that epic, heroic feel, you know, with a bit of jungle flavoring added in, but you're not going to hum it afterwards.
No.
Oh, and speaking of which, I meant to put this somewhere in the feedback on The Shadow episode, which, speaking of which, we really got to do our feedback next time, but... I remember how I mentioned in The Shadow how it sounded like Kenny G music when Lamont and Lamont and Margot met in the restaurant.
Right.
It was Kenny G music.
Oh, I remember you telling me that.
But after we recorded it.
Yeah, yeah.
But he provided music there, and somebody decided it was a good idea to drop it into a club where they'd been playing music as if it was real music from the '40s. Now, this movie doesn't have any of that, which, thankfully.
No.
One thing you did point out, though, you pointed out while we were watching it, and I looked for it again, and I couldn't see any explanation. It said that this started, it was 1938 in the Bengala jungle. But yet, when they get to New York, there's flags on the outside of the museum that says 1939 New York.
See, I just...
Now, unless that was a promotion for the New York World's Fair that in real life really happened in 1939, it may have been, but it didn't say World's Fair that I saw. So unless this movie maybe took place over, you know, over the gap between 38 and 39, but I kind of doubt it. There was no Christmas or it wasn't wintertime in New York.
No.
So now I enjoy this movie. I think it's a better looking movie than The Shadow, as we pointed out. But having watched these two relatively back to back, I think The Shadow is actually a more fun movie overall, and it gels better than this one. And I didn't think that before we watched these two again.
Right. Especially this close together.
Yeah, I remember telling you I think I like The Phantom better. And I like The Phantom. I like The Phantom himself, Billy Zane, and I like the cinematography and the locale and the overall feel of the movie, but it loses points because of Christy Swanson's sluggish performance and Treat Williams over the top. I mean, if those two could balance each other out,
exactly,
then we'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But he's nuts and she's asleep.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, she phoned in her performance and he paraded through the production like a Mardi Gras float. You know, so that's our take on The Phantom. It's actually out on Netflix. Now, I don't know if The Shadow is, but I saw where The Phantom is. So if you got Netflix, you can go watch it for, well, relatively for free.
Yeah.
So go watch it. It's worth it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it again. Danny watched it with us and she liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So one last bit about The Phantom. A few years back, the folks at Castaway Toys made an officially licensed 8-inch Mego-style figure of The Phantom. And I was lucky enough to do the artwork and the packaging design for that release.
Which is awesome.
And my friend Bobby White did the photography on the card backs. They also had the Captain Action license, and I drew the Phantom and his foe Redbeard for that as well. So as a fan of comics and toys, that was quite a thrill to get to contribute a tiny, 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 tiny bit of real official Phantom history with those releases. So I can say I officially drew the Phantom.
Yes, you did.
On an official piece of merchandise.
Yes, you did. And that's my awesome.
That's my favorite comic-related job that I've ever done. So I can, you know, I did, you know, I can always say, hey, I drew
the Phantom.
The Phantom. So and I'm just blowing my horn a little bit because it just really means a lot to me.
Hey, I mean, those are great. I mean,
those figures are awesome too. That's an awesome figure of the
but
Phantom.
Your card work makes them pop.
Well,
I can brag on you, so.
Ow! You ain't had that in a while. We've been trying to kind of, you know, steer away from the overly. We don't want it to become our bazinga.
Yeah. You know. But he deserves to get hit. I'm allowed to brag on him, and he can take a compliment.
Okay, well, I'll take the compliment. Thanks. Well, that'll do it for now. We'll be back in probably about 2 weeks, and we'll see what we get into then. I really don't know.
Me either.
Yeah, me neither. We got a couple things in the works, and a couple plans, and of course, if you like this format with the movies, of course, if you like to talk about movies, go to the Film and Water podcast on the Fire and Water Network, of course, with Rob and a rotating series of guests. But Cindy and I will be talking movies again come September as we return to the House of Frankenstein.
Yes, yes.
So we'll be talking a movie and a comic related to that horror movie, classic horror movie. So that should be fun, and I've got to start putting a list together and scrutinize.
We'll put it together.
We'll scrutinize, and, you know, last year I, like, just labored and labored over that and beat my head against the wall about what we wanted to do.
I know. But it's okay.
So
it's all good.
Yeah, it's all good, and it's fun, so we're looking forward to that. But we've got several more episodes in between, and I got a few ideas of what to do. These episodes were a lot of fun, and this was Cindy's idea to do these, so I really enjoyed it, so I'm glad you came up with that. Plus, I didn't have to think about something to do, so that was great.
See, there you go.
So that was good. I still had to do all the damn notes, but I didn't have to think about something to do.
Folks, I'm telling you, even though he gripes about the notes, he loves to do this crap. He loves to research and nitpick, and, oh, well, did you know that so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so was related back to blah, 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 blah. Trust me, he likes it. He's just bitching to bitch.
I just wish I had more time to do it in, and I wasn't always up against the wire, but you know, that's part of it. So we hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide and is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com.
Comments can be left at supermatescomic.blogspot.com or by visiting fireandwaterpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates and FW Podcast Network. Follow us on Twitter by using the hashtag FW Podcast.
Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast. So B-Boys make some noise and just